You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Welcome, listeners, to another episode of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. I'm here with Julie. Hi, Julie.
Hi.
And we have agreed that we want to talk about another great film. As we've done in the past, we've selected one single movie to really dive into more deeply. And Julie, it was actually you who suggested that we talk about a Sidney Lumet film, one that I haven't seen and you seem to know and like a lot, as I assumed. And I had a chance to see it for the very first time, the 1975 thriller heist movie, Dog Day Afternoon. And today we want to talk about that film in particular. And of course, I would like to know from you, Julie, first of all, why this choice? What do you think of the film in general? What is the one reason or the reasons that make it stand out for you?
Well, the idea came up, as you said, to do a great film episode. And we'd never done a film by Sidney Lumet, not specifically. And so what's, you know, a great film by Sidney Lumet? And then it turns out that Where My Head Goes is a different direction to Where My Heart Goes. And although I would love to have discussed a classic with you, Dog Day Afternoon is just one of my favorites of his. So that's why we plumped for it and went for it and said, okay, let's do Dog Day Afternoon, because I do love the film. So I might be a teeny bit biased as well. And I think it's interesting because of the time it was made, but even still today, in how it deals with genre. I'd call it a crime drama, even though that's meaningless. How it deals with genre and how it deals with character and how those two fit together in the sort of journey Sidney Lumet takes. So that's why I went for this one. There's culturally and stylistically so much that we can get into about this film.
Maybe at this point it would be good to mention to our listeners that if you haven't seen the film Dog Day Afternoon, maybe come back and listen to us when you have seen it, because it's one of those films, and I experienced that just when I watched it, that develops in a certain way that is full of surprises, twists and turns, unexpected elements that come in. So I think it's really a movie that you have to experience before you listen to any discussion or read any article about it. And thank you again, Julie, for that warning. So spoiler alert, in the next minutes and so on, we will talk about everything in detail. So everything will be spoiled. So please come back to us if you haven't seen it yet. Maybe do we need to mention a few words about the movie, how it's set up for our listeners, and then take it from there. It starts off on a sweltering afternoon in New York. We see a lot of different scenes of New York life, contrasting scenes, it seems. Some of them seem pretty, some of them seem gritty. And we get an image, an impression of that moment in time. And then we end up in front of a bank in Brooklyn where a car is parked and three men are supposedly planning, discussing to go into this bank. And we must assume, seeing Al Pacino and John Cazale and their other accomplice, that there's going to be a successful or violent or surprising bank robbery. Something is planned. We have no words, no conversation yet. And then the movie starts with the men entering the bank. That's kind of the setup. So I think a lot of things that go through our mind from the beginning, and especially seeing Pacino and John Cazale, we might think, well, this is something that we've seen before, something that goes a certain way. And maybe just to ask you, Julie, how do you think this setup works at the very beginning? What kind of expectations do we have where this is going?
Well, they're clearly tense. They are tense in this car. One of the nice little gimmicks is that we have this beautiful music underneath the intro scene that you just described so nicely. And of course, when Pacino turns the car radio off, the music stops and we go into the film. So that's a nice little trick that Lumet pulls. Two tense guys in a car in front of a bank, one being Al Pacino of Godfather fame and John Cazale, same. So you're thinking heist film, at least I did, right? They're very tense heist film. This is going to be maybe about this heist gone terribly wrong. It says in the opening credits it's based on a true story. So you're already primed to pay attention because this is not a fictional film. So you don't know what's going to happen. Truth may be stranger than fiction. And then to get a little bit more into it, they go into the bank. They even let a mother and child leave before the robbery starts. Take out weapons and shout, don't move, right? This is a robbery. And then the third accomplice says, I can't do this, Sonny. I can't do this. I'm sorry. I'm going to have to leave. And Sonny, that's Pacino's character, reacts so naturally, like, what the, what, you know, what's happening? He's allowed to leave. And as he leaves, Sonny has to remind him, give me the keys to the car, because that's my getaway vehicle. And he's like, yeah, but how do I get home? And this is the start of the film. This is what sets you up and go like, okay, this is going to be nothing like I thought it would be.
Such an ingenious beginning. Also, I noticed how we're so focused on Pacino from the very start, his facial reactions, how he tries to be in control of that situation from the start. But then I think by the moment he unpacks his gun from that package and it somehow goes wrong a little bit already. It gets stuck and he needs to kind of shake it off. I thought, okay, so this is definitely not going the way, or is not definitely not going to go smoothly for them. And I think from then on, you have these comedic elements that come in. It has elements of absurd comedy that come back throughout the film that especially sets it up from the beginning.
Yeah, though this is not a comedy, as we are describing it now, it sounds like some sort of farce. But it really is not, because things get very serious really, really fast. And you're back to square one with the robbery going terribly wrong, because, of course, the cops show up. And they don't just show up with three vehicles. They show up with helicopters. They show up with guns, sirens blaring. And later when the FBI asks the cop in charge, the police officer in charge, why the heck he would do that for two guys in a bank, he said, I made an error in judgment. And here the film goes into almost commentary, like, why would the police escalate this situation that we as the audience know? Of course, it's serious. But it may just not be deadly if we just keep talking. But the police go in, guns drawn, right?
With everything. Snipers, right. And helicopters. Snipers. And masses of police, the FBI, everything is on place. And there's this massive power contrast, the two men in the bank with their hostages and this mass of police FBI force outside. And it seems like clear that, or to us at that point, that they are highly at a disadvantage now. So what's going to happen? What is going to be the next thing? And I thought this contrast between what we think is a beginning is kind of comical, but then turns into something that blows out of proportion. That's where the movie takes so much of its suspense from. I felt on the edge of my seat because of these shifts, these constant shifts of also power relationships in the bank, with the robbers inside, with Al Pacino and the police, these conversations that they have. There was constantly something where, even in my notes, I wrote down power shift.
Right.
And I think that is really one of the things that stood out to me from the very beginning.
And then there's how Al Pacino responds to this. So Sonny, who is supposed to be in charge and threatens to lose control bit by bit all through the film. But he also has John Cazale, who is his companion Sal, who responds to the stress very differently. Very quickly, it emerges that Sal may just be very dangerous. He is losing it. He is losing his nerve. He may be losing his mind. He cannot stand the stress, the pressure cooker that he's in. And you start to realize he may be a loose cannon. So as the pressure rises and the police ratchet up the pressure bit by bit, you as the audience, and Sonny, of course, know this could get really explosive. And you get to know all the hostages. They're such lovely characters, all in themselves. You don't want to lose any of them. You don't want someone to get hurt. You really don't. You're so invested. And this also gives a sort of tension in that Sal later says in the film, he can't go back to jail and contemplates a double suicide or a murder suicide, even out of pure desperation. He is just an unstable person being put under an incredible amount of stress. So you sense, even though it never dehumanizes Sal as a human being, you sense that this is beyond a tricky situation now.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting how the threats also shift in the film, where you stand as an audience, where you see the most dangerous element come in for them, for the hostages, Sal as a possible loose cannon, and then the negotiations that go on outside, with Sonny always stepping out to talk to the inspector and to talk to the FBI guy. And I think one of the most fascinating elements also standing out was the social tension as well that is brought into the film with the outside, where there's also a crowd gathering that we haven't mentioned yet that starts to first be onlookers and, of course, fascinated by what's going on. But then Sonny discovers how he can play with that audience and how they start to cheer for
press,
him. And the press.
The press comes out in full force immediately, partly because the police comes out in full force. And, of course, everything is televised. There are helicopters everywhere. And Sonny realizes that this may be his only leverage out of the situation, that everything he does will now be immediately broadcast on TV, radio, wherever.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very modern thought that this is instantaneous. We see later in the film that he gets on a call with some sort of talk show host, uses some very colorful language, and gets cut off again. But the mere fact that he's talking and instantaneously being broadcast is an idea that I think sort of makes it a very modern concept.
And also how he says, I'm running this at all kinds of points, reasserting that he's in charge of that, that he can give the orders through the media, but also in his negotiations outside and inside as well. But we know, of course, that, as you said, control is slowly slipping from his hands.
He doth protest too much. Yeah. He's hanging on for dear life.
So now that we've kind of set up the main tensions and elements of the film and the basic context where the plot starts off and where it goes in the first, I would say, half hour, maybe we can also talk about specific moments in the film that then follow that are important to us and that maybe also make this a film that lives off the small moments, also the side characters, that it was something I strongly felt that, as you said, we care for all the members of the hostage group, but we also see the perspectives of the FBI guy. We see this perspective of the inspector, the predicaments that they are in as well. Plus, of course, family members. So I think it lives off a lot of moments that are strung together so expertly in the film and that build up this tension. So I wanted to ask you, Julie, what are standout moments for you in Dog Day Afternoon?
This is not chronological, by the way. I'm going to skip through the film generally. But one of the nice moments that goes to the themes that Lumet is interested in is when Sonny gets to order pizza via the police because they need some food, right? In real life, he wanted hamburgers because he hates pizza, but he got pizza anyway. In the movie, he asks for pizza. And the pizza guy comes to deliver these pizzas in this, well, I'm not going to call it a war zone because that would be overstating things, but between armed police and the cheering crowds and the press helicopters and everything, and you have this hostage situation inside. He has to deliver these pizzas. Sonny insists on paying him. And after the pizzas are given and Sonny goes back into the bank, the pizza guy turns to the crowd and with an enormous grin says, I'm a star. That was one of those moments that I just, that was beautiful. So that is definitely one. There is a moment where there is talk of a hostage exchange. So one of the ladies, the senior teller, gets to go outside, just stick her nose outside a little bit with Sonny. And there's an offer for her to go into the police to be exchanged as a hostage, so to leave. And she then says, well, I can't leave my girls, which is really sympathetic. And that moment is then broken by the crowd cheering and she giving a little wave like, hey, and then goes back into the bank. That's another one. And then one that gives an makes it so modern and gives it an idea of the sort of tension. When Sonny's in the bank, sweating it out with hostages and Sal cracking up, he's in contact with the police and everybody via phone, logically. So at some point, the phone rings. Sonny picks it up and it's a crank caller saying horrible things like shoot them all and kill them all. And I don't have it verbatim here. And Sonny just hangs up the phone in sort of shock. Like, how horrible. How do people think of, you know, calling a bank in a hostage situation and telling the perpetrator to kill them all? It's a shocking moment. So those are my sort of little tidbits that make the movie special.
And they all kind of paint a portrait of how people react differently or would react differently in such a situation. How that triggers so many different responses. I'm also thinking of the guy that attacks Sonny outside at one point because his girlfriend is on the inside. Or the different groups of people protesting outside for different causes.
Mm.
I think one standout moment we'll probably talk about later is about one group in particular that start to protest outside for Sonny. But we'll have to talk about that later because the movie starts shifting in all kinds of directions that we don't expect. But I think it's also the phone moments that stand out. I thought this is such a clever film, how it uses the sounds in general. And particular sounds then specifically, and I think the phone sound is so prevalent in that film, how it cuts through, how it structures certain scenes, how it makes us nervous, how it makes, of course, Sonny and Sal nervous. So who's going to be on the phone? Who's going to be ready to talk? Who's not going to be ready? I think throughout the film, those were kind of highlights for me. Whenever the phone rang, you knew there was another twist and turn in the film. And negotiations would go on, or that crank caller would call again. But for me, what stood out as moments as well was wherever that tension was broken again by the lighter moments. And I think this group of women hostages inside had a lot also, even though they're of course nervous and afraid. But then the longer this ordeal goes on, the more also they become a little cheeky and a little relaxed. And they talk to Sal about smoking, I think, at one point, and morals. And they start to say on the phone, I think it's Carol Kane, who has a small part as well. She talks to her boyfriend and he asks her, when is this going to be over? Because I expect you back for dinner. You know, when you're getting at home.
You have to make my dinner. That's exactly. Incredible. And the way she responds to this is like, well, you can just heat up something that's in the fridge and I'm sure it'll be okay. And this guy, I mean, she's a hostage and he's like, where's my dinner?
And she says something like, we're having a bank robbery.
Yeah.
Very matter of fact. So I think that were highlights for me, especially in that first half of the film, how in a way you see how so many people react differently. You would expect them to act a certain way and maybe the violence to escalate and the two guys just to be the bad guys and the hostages to be our side that we root for. But I think the film throws us into all kinds of directions. And I think that gives it such a complete picture at the end, almost, of the different perspectives.
You expect a good guy, bad guy dynamic. And Lumet just doesn't give you a good guy, bad guy dynamic. Everybody's troubled. Everybody's in difficulty. Everybody's worried. Everybody's stressed out. So you don't get the hero villain thing at all.
And the complexities increase as the movie goes on. I think that's what makes it so fascinating. And maybe that gives us a chance also to talk about the characters themselves a little bit more and how they're treated by Sidney Lumet. I think at the center, obviously, we have Sonny and Sal as our supposed main characters. What do you think makes that unique? The way Lumet works here with the main characters, but also with the side characters.
Well, it's illustrated very nicely with Pacino as Sonny, because Lumet clearly plays with our expectations, right? As we talked about at the beginning of this pod, you expect him to be a criminal perpetrating a heist, maybe a heroic criminal, right? And then he turns into almost an activist. There's a scene when he exits the bank. He has on his mind, as a sideline, a prison riot that happened in real life in which I think 42 people died. They were shot, if memory serves. And this is preying on his mind. He thinks the police is out to just kill them. And so even though this prison riot has nothing to do with the situation in hand, he at some point exits the bank and starts shouting, Attica, Attica, Attica. And the crowd knows what he's on about and shout with him. And he is sort of an activist, but an activist in terms of the situation makes him almost an activist or an unlikely hero. You find out later that his activism and his heroism is of a completely different level than just being anti-police or being anti-violence. So this is Sonny the activist. So as we go through the film, we get to know different aspects of Sonny. First he's a criminal, then he's a bungler, then he's just a schmuck. And then he's actually pretty human guy who wants to make sure that the hostages are okay and people with medical problems find their way out and everybody gets to go to the loo and all this stuff that happens when you interact with people. And he becomes this unlikely activist type. And then, and we'll get into this later, we go into the biggest plot twist of this film, and he becomes something else entirely. So this is the way that I think Lumet sets him up, as to just mess with our expectations in what kind of film this is supposed to be. And by the end, when all's said and done, I don't even know if I had to give a genre to this film, what genre would it be except the completely meaningless term crime drama, which could basically be anything. But it's a film about people, as all Lumet's films are films about people. And that's what makes this particular story, even though it could have been a very sensationalist, farcical dramedy, makes this such a human story at its heart.
And we're not being manipulated into one or the other way. I think we have a lot of space to think and feel of the characters over the course of the film. And one thing that I wrote down about the ending of the film is like, how am I feeling right now about Sonny as well, the way things turn out. And that, I think, again, leaves a lot open to feel about what he's been through, but also what, of course, the characters have been through that he affected by this plan that he initiated.
And who he is.
Exactly.
How do we now look at him?
That's such a complex character. Maybe, as we talked about Sonny already and about Sal only briefly, one association I had with him for a while, I'm not sure if that makes sense to you, is that the dynamic between them and the way that Sal acted was a bit of mice and men dynamic. I wrote down Sal is a bit like Lenny.
Steinbeckian.
You in a way can't talk to him. He seems removed from obvious feelings, and he's kind of moving into himself and pondering now some kind of a dramatic or drastic action at the end, killing everybody, like you said, committing suicide. And that, I thought, was such an interesting dynamic that then came out between the characters, that Sonny needed to negotiate between the outside and making sure that Sal was under control. And I think at one point realizing that the goal was for the police and the FBI to especially take care of Sal once they were outside.
Yeah.
And I think that also plays into what you said before. Sonny, in a way, becomes even approachable to the police and the FBI. They're able to talk to him. They I think they can see that he takes care of the hostages, and they, in a way, also start to build a certain trust for the steps that they're taking. Maybe just to say here, they demand for first a helicopter and then a plane to fly out of the country. They want to go to Algeria,
yeah.
Of all places. And at the end, they get that small airport bus, and they do get, in fact, or what we think will get, in fact, that plane to fly out. And then things, of course, turn out very differently. But I think there is that level of they can work together, but the problem remains Sal and how this, as you said, the loose cannon will act.
Yeah, and it's very sad because, again, there is a very fine balance here between comedy and an actual tragedy. And at some point, and this is already 1.5 hours into the film, the FBI starts negotiating directly with Sonny. And at some point, the FBI agent says very sort of firmly to Sonny, we'll take care of Sal. We as the audience sort of sense that this is going to not end well for him. And I think Sonny does too. And there's an incredible sort of sadness in that this guy that we've come to know as somebody who's just fractured, not a bad guy, is just fractured in his mind, is going to possibly be taken down because he's just a loose cannon, right? He just unpredictable. And when they huddle into the police bus, they huddle around Sal into the police bus sideways. And I think this is, it's never exactly said this way, but I think it's like Sonny's last stand to try and protect Sal, because he senses that this is going to be his weak spot and that Sal's going to be taken out.
Mm-hmm. That they will take care of him outside. Yeah, and that again increases the tension so much more about this scene when they're out of the bank finally and getting into that bus. And we kind of know that that might be coming. And I feel the sadness is also increased by Sal somewhat suspecting for a while that there is something going on that he doesn't know about, when Sonny always goes to talk to the police outside. At one point he asks, well, what did you talk about? And Sonny obviously lies. And I think Sal, again, I had memories of Mice and Men here, with George knowing what's going to happen to Lenny and Sonny here as well. It was very, very sad and increased the suspense that we felt once they were outside.
Yeah, and I think it bears pointing out here that part of this film is actually based on a true story. This sort of bank heist sort of actually happened. And Sal, you know, we've already given the spoiler warning, but Sal is taken down at the end. And Sal in real life was a 19-year-old kid. And I think Cazale, although he was nearer 40 when he played in this, I think it was 39 or something, he gives it such gravitas, perhaps to do justice to the actual real-life character of Sal, but perhaps also because the role merits it and it's so well written, is that there's a real sort of, even though we all know that Sal, because he's unpredictable, is incredibly dangerous, we still hope somehow they will figure something out to get him into a mental hospital to get treatment for some sort of post-traumatic stress disorder. But we sense, of course, this can only go one way because the FBI is involved and lots of cops with lots of guns. This is not going to end well, right?
Mm-hmm. We just don't know how badly it will end, but we sense that it will. And I think what comes to that is also that we care about all the characters involved here, and they all have their vignette moments. We already mentioned the hostages, but I think once we start expanding on the different characters that we see, I think we also have to include the family of Sonny that comes in.
Yeah.
And there is a heartbreaking / comical scene with his mother meeting him outside of the bank and giving him advice, telling him what he should do, telling him how his father feels about the whole situation. And it's a heartbreaking moment and so well acted. And I was reminded of a number of Lumet scenes where he brings in one actor or actress and he lets them just in there for 4 or 5 minutes and they deliver something heart-wrenching and something so, so powerful. And the mother scene was definitely one. His wife as well, the wife we believe to be his wife in one scene, is a powerhouse of an actress as well, and really gives us a sense of what kind of family situation Sonny might be in. But I think now we need to talk also about a character that is brought in to the movie exactly halfway. And
exactly
I checked this when
halfway.
I was watching it.
Yes.
1 hour into the film of this 2-hour movie, with the police saying that Sonny's wife is going to meet him at the bank, because that was one of his demands, a helicopter, a plane, and meeting his wife outside of the bank. We, of course, expect the obvious, this wife that we've seen in the short scene
before. Yeah, his ex-wife, yeah.
Will show up and there will be some kind of conversation, confrontation, whatever. But then something else completely happens.
They bring out his actual wife.
And his wife is someone called Leon, who turns out to be a man or not, or no longer, or about to become a woman.
Yeah.
There is talk of a sex change operation, and this wife, husband, Leon, is brought into the barbershop across and refuses to talk to Sonny on the phone at first, having just come out of a mental hospital where that operation was supposed to take place.
In their pajamas. I mean, it's humiliating. They drag them out of the hospital in their pajamas and then plump them in this barbershop, completely confused, half-drugged, and it's very affecting. They're played by Chris Sarandon. That gives our audience an idea of what they look like and why. Because this is made in 1975, nobody's worried about pronouns. So Leon is called Leon and him or her, or, you know, the language in this and about this, and especially from the cops, is incredibly offensive to modern ears. I mean, they use terms that I'm like, dude, no.
Please no, yeah.
Please no. The real life character was, I think, Elizabeth Eden, who became a she. And indeed, the sex change operation was given by the real-life Sonny in court as the motivation for this robbery. So This is not as weird as it may look. Prima facie, this is something that was actually a real life thing. And indeed, Leon does not want to talk to Sonny because they say Sonny is insane. Just crazy, unpredictable, possibly abusive even. They say, no, look, dude, I can't talk to him. And of course, Leon is talked into it. And they have this wonderful, affecting phone conversation, which is intercut between Sonny and Leon. And it's one of the highlights. I don't know how you feel about this, but this is one of my highlights of the film, is this phone conversation.
Oh, I mean, the whole switch after hour one just completely blew my mind. I had such expectations of where this was going. I was intrigued. I was involved. And then this happened. And I only wrote down question marks and exclamation marks for a while because I thought, oh, wow, this really has just shifted the whole thing into such a different direction. It became so much more personal, so much more. It's at stake now also for Sonny and how this will play out for him personally, with the police, with the media. So much more was happening suddenly. And I was so surprised that the 1975 movie would go there. And even though I felt the language was offensive, I didn't feel that the treatment of the relationship or the relationship they were shown to have was offensive. Even though we knew, possibly abusive, definitely with a lot of issues involved. But I felt once that conversation happened, you really felt the sense of realism between them. And what a feat to accomplish at this point, to make that so affecting and human and real, and to give that as a context in a time when 70s Hollywood was still having horrible representations of gay characters all over. They're mostly psychopaths and villains and cartoonish.
Or they're pathetic victims or, yeah, something awful.
Definitely. And I felt this was really the big, big surprise. And I think I was 100% more involved even in the film after that. And you say correctly, one of the highlights is definitely the phone conversation. And one thing I noticed is how we get closer and closer to them and their relationship. And at the end, there's a heartbreaking farewell also from Leon's side, because Sonny, of course, was in the bank eventually to get the money for that sex change operation. It's not very expensive. I mean, it's not like, it's like $2,700, I think. But there's not enough money in the bank, maybe just to add to that at the beginning. They can't find enough. And we know that he's not going to make it, but we feel that he was really doing it specifically for Leon. Maybe also to, or yeah, most likely also to get him back or to show him that he cares for him. And Leon at the end says, I'm happy where I am at the hospital. I want to go back. This is farewell.
They didn't even want to leave. They were just extracted from a place of healing to this conflict situation. It really is. And what's interesting is that Lumet has said that he was, with this film, he was very worried about any hint of sensationalism, right? Especially with the LGBTQ angle. And so was Pacino. And initially, there was supposed to be a kiss between the two, and Pacino balked. He said, I don't, because that's now going to be exploitative. And he said, I want to focus on that the relationship is breaking apart, not on what the relationship is, whether any relationship. And that really did communicate, I think. So the screenwriter adapted that. And that really did communicate, because this would have easily been extremely exploitative if they had not handled it quite as delicately as they did. I think I remember one quote that was really cute, is that Chris Sarandon really wanted this part. Who can blame him? I mean, it's a great part. And I think Lumet told him a little less Blanche Dubois from Streetcar Named Desire and a little more Queen's Housewife. And I think that really communicates to how Sarandon now approaches this role. He's a little bit, he wheedles a little bit, but he's not whiny. He's like, no, look, and I'm using he because it's he in the film, obviously. In real life, who knows, Elizabeth Eden probably said she. Like, Sonny, I want you out of my life. We have two people with severe mental health issues, and we're just an explosive combination. And it's just all bad. It's not good. Get out of my life. And Sonny stages this incredible, almost coercive, controlling coup with the press and the bank and the police to get to talk to Leon. I mean, it's the way that Leon handles this lover of his, this husband, was incredibly controlling. It's also clever and empathetic. Like, I understand that you're in a very hard place, but I need you to get out of my life and leave me in the hospital where I can regain some of my health. What are you doing?
And it's so subtly done, I think, between them, the personal relationship that they show in that conversation that in a way isolates them as well. That's one sense that I had. They are already isolated as characters, but you feel how they're reconnecting, how there is a... It's very believable as well, I had the impression. It's not done for camp, or it's not done for sensationalism at all. I felt that Chris Sarandon was neither Queen nor Blanche DuBois or anything. He was just very human and relatable in that scene. And I could again see how Lumet can make any character in the few moments that he has in the film. There are a few more than some of the other characters, but have such an intimacy and such realism. And you feel so much that this is someone who's lived that biography. It's not just a role that comes up for a certain effect or for a certain plot point.
No.
And I felt that was such a strong moment. And of course, also a turning point in a sense of Pacino and his motive and what he wanted to achieve somehow in shambles. And notice, really, I saw that afterwards we also have Darkness Fall outside.
Yeah.
One thing that I noted down next was suddenly we're in the dark as well. And the lights go out and we go into this last third of the film, I guess, where we slowly move towards the fulfillment of their plan. They're going to the airport and possibly flying away. So very, very lovely structured as well as a screenplay.
Yeah, it's very well written. The screenplay by Pierce is really very well done. I mean, it's an incredible feat of writing. Even just the dialogue, the accents, the way that these people sound as if they're actually speaking. They don't sound scripted at all.
Not at all, not in any moment.
And there are improvisational moments. I mean, famously, Sonny is making this huge, it's a megalomaniacal plan to escape with helicopters. And of course, it's completely unrealistic. And he thinks it's going to work and they're going to go abroad to another country. And he's trying to explain to Sal, if we do this, we can still escape. We don't have to kill ourselves or do anything drastic. We can still escape. But we can never go back to America. So what country do you want to go to? And Sal says, Wyoming. I think this was unscripted. This is one of the unscripted moments in the film.
Wow.
And this is what, I'm not sure. Twitter will correct me if I'm wrong. But I think this was an unscripted improvisational moment. And this is, it fits in the film so perfectly. It just tells on how well this film is written and how well it's done, that these kinds of gems bubble to the surface in what basically is a doomsday scenario, because it's a tragedy, right? The clock is wound up at the very beginning and it can only wind down to its inevitable conclusion. And still it has these brilliant little moments and brilliant little characters.
Well, stylistically, what would you say are other elements that stand out here? I think we mentioned quite a few of them already. For instance, the use of silence and dialogue, sounds that play a big role. I'm also thinking of this break of tension with slightly comical or absurd moments. We have darkness falling, so kind of everything happening in real time here. What else stands out in terms of style for you?
It's very naturalistic. It's almost as a documentary film. So no costumes. Everybody's there in basically their own clothes. So the crowd and the mob and the press and all these people are not costumed. They're just put on their jean jacket. And also, the colors are very, a little bit, I don't mean to say all over the place, but malaid. It's not one piece of red and one piece of green. It doesn't pop out. It's just almost this documentary sea of different little, like a beautiful tapestry, right? And in that, it feels very documentary, like it feels very unscripted, very naturalistic, even though, of course, it can't be a documentary because nobody's bringing a camera into their own bank robbery, even though this is now 2023, you never know. But it has that feel to it. That's a very naturalistic feel. And I think this is what sets it apart, not only as a crime drama.
And also, I think what stands out for me was that how this naturalistic style seems simple at first and very focused on this being inside the bank. I expected it to be kind of this we claw this closed-in chamber piece drama and everything will be happening inside the bank. But then I noticed how it also becomes quite elaborate in the way it is made. I'm thinking of these long dolly shots back and forth in the bank that I noticed to increase kind of the urgency, the tension. And then suddenly outside we see helicopters in midair. We see helicopters from the top down onto the bank, which becomes this massive scene where the crowds are gathering. So it also goes between the very simple, intimate moments focused very much on the characters, like we said, but then also showing the big picture, including those crowds. And I think that's one element. I'm not sure if you can call it stylistic. It's more like a part of the plot, part of the content, is this that we see these social movements erupt. There is an enormous sense of power that could break out at any moment also on the street. That here in the mid-70s, post-Watergate and Vietnam, and or just in the middle of all this, and with all these liberation movements, and there's that interesting moment that we mentioned before briefly where there are LGBTQ plus people protesting in the street now for Sonny.
Yeah, because first they love him. Then because he's such an activist, then it comes out that he's, as they put it, a homosexual. Then everybody hates him. And then the gay pride movement shows up.
Yes.
And loves him we alluded to this before, loves him as suddenly this sort of gay rights icon, as you would have put it at the time, right? That was just a heartwarming, that was brilliant, a brilliant, brilliant moment.
And also a comment on how people just read certain situations without knowing the big picture, but they claim it for themselves. And I think there was an enormous also commentary here. I mean, I'm thinking of Network, and we'll probably talk about that a little later. Another movie that plays a lot or says a lot about media versus audience relationship and what it can trigger, but just how that power kettle every once in a while would almost break out. And at one point that the idea that maybe that would be their saving grace, that somehow one of these groups would get involved and help them out at the end and maybe make it possible. But instead, I think the last thing of the crowd we see is that they're following the airport bus, and some of them are really also abusive against Sonny and Sal.
Hecklers,
so there's all kinds of reactions. It also doesn't want to give a wrong impression of how something can be saved. You know, you can be saved by something unexpected. Here, I think it goes down to this very focused realism at the end. And I think that made it so fascinating that there were so many possibilities that were shown, such a big picture that we get of that situation and reactions of all kinds of people and groups involved. That made it really powerful.
And to get back a little bit about how this translates stylistically with Lumet, I think nothing interests him as much as the human face. So he does these beautiful, almost portraits of all the characters, pretty close up as well, especially the main characters and the little ensemble that we have in the bank, right? And he has said, I could probably never do a Western because I might as well shoot a face against a blank wall. He typically does these enclosed spaces. And it's interesting because here that's juxtaposed, as you say, with these helicopter shots, the sheer scale of the crowd, and then these very enclosed shots of people's faces and emotions, and Al Pacino with these huge eyes, always on the brink of a panic, which he doesn't quite fall into. It's brilliant work.
Well, talking of Lumet and his films, I think we made cross-references to other of his films already a little bit. And it might be a good moment also to talk to connections maybe that we had to other films that he made, or Lumet generally about his films. Like, what are some of your favorite Lumet films, or the ones that you most associated maybe with this one, or contrast the most with this one?
Well, the contrast is easy. That would be The Wiz. No, I'm joking, of course. I think the classic big Lumet film, and one of my favorites, is 12 Angry Men. But that works more as an allegory than Dog Day Afternoon does. And the same goes for Network, which is an incredible piece of work, but it also almost serves as an allegory about the situation in America, the way media influences the normal people and the public, but also the people in the media. And Dog Day Afternoon is such an almost documentary style film that it doesn't have these sort of almost allegory-like, the heightened style and type of storytelling. that he uses there. And then later in, for instance, The Verdict, which is highly recommended with Paul Newman, and Before the Devil Knows You're Dead with Ethan Hawke and Philip Seymour Hoffman. These are really heightened dramas. In The Verdict, it's a courtroom drama, and in Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, it's a crime drama, again, crime drama. But these are very heightened drama films. And Dog Day Afternoon is one of the most, I won't say casual, but one of the most naturalistic films, I think. And that's what sets it apart from Lumet's prolific body of work. I think he's done a little bit of everything, hasn't he?
Yeah, and you go into a Lumet film with certain expectations and certain echoes, I felt. Like you said, when they went into the bank, I thought it's going to be this closed-in situation, just like in 12 Angry Men, and then the dynamic is only going to play out between those limited characters in there, but it gives you something else. And I think it's an interesting comparison to say the other movies were rather allegories, because I felt also here I was more involved with the characters themselves. I felt more for them. And if I'm thinking of all the jurors in 12 Angry Men or the media personalities in Network, those are kind of my two Lumet go-to movies that I've seen 100 times and I really loved bits. But it's not that you're really terribly emotionally involved with the characters.
No.
There are certain types and there are certain representations of something that you recognize. And one of the standout characters for me is always Faye Dunaway in Network, and how she comes across as this career woman in that media circus, and how she goes through, you know, such a hype in her career. And you're not emotionally involved with her, but of course you see where this is going. You understand the drama in that and the relationships in that. And here I felt, no, I mean, Sonny and Sal and lots of the other characters, including Leon, that they went deep. This was about their story as well, not necessarily about the comment about the media, even though that played a big role as well, and the reactions of people closed in a certain space, which played a role as well, including the hostages and the security guy and the different people involved in there. I felt it echoed a lot of Lumet's work, but he did something else with it entirely. And that I loved in terms of the characters and the content. And I think love this no-nonsense approach that Lumet has. It's one of those filmmakers where any movie I've seen, and apart from the ones mentioned, I've also seen Family Business, the Anderson tapes. So where Sean Connery was mostly involved, he loved Lumet and worked with him 4 times altogether. And Murder in the Orient Express.
Yes.
the 1974. Four version, if I'm not mistaken.
The one with Bacall, Lauren Bacall, and Ingrid Bergman
and my God. Sean Wendy Connery. Hiller. It's a fantastic star ensemble. It's also Lumet film. But I think they share that no-nonsense approach. It's very dry. It lets every character shine and have their very human moments. And in most of them, there's also an enormous concentration on a buildup of suspense, often without music or with very little music. So I find them all incredibly suspenseful, successful in what they achieve, even though they have so many different approaches, styles, eras that they were made from between the 50s and the early 2000s, if I'm not mistaken. And that is an incredible body of work to look at.
Absolutely. I have a soft spot for Dog Day Afternoon because of the reasons that you just mentioned. Where Network, and by the way, kudos to Dunaway, who does the best bad girl since Barbara Stanwyck in this one.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's fabulous. They are more allegories of problems in America. And I think the more human ones, for instance, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead and The Verdict, tend to ring loudest with me. Lumet is so good at people. And I think that shines through. And that's why I picked this one. And this is why this is a particular favorite of mine, because it's all about the people.
So I think implicitly we've already answered the question whether one should still watch Dog Day Afternoon, whether it still has relevance for today. But let's maybe go into that question as well. So what are the reasons why we should watch Dog Day Afternoon still? What makes it such a classic still for an audience today? And how is it still relevant?
Well, I think basically the humanity and gender issues and the way that gender issues are portrayed and the way the media handles gender issues and issues of identification as a farce or as a joke. And kudos to Lumet that the jokes that are made about these characters by the police, but also the way that they are euphemistically talked over by the media, is portrayed as incredibly offensive. And it is incredibly offensive. And sadly, we are not much further today in these issues of identification than we were in 1975. There's still such an enormous fight to be fought and such a long way to go until there's any hope of equity, which is sort of why this movie still matters and why the humanizing of these characters still matters. But also, I think, why the issues of how media influences people and the way people act and interact when they are in the glare of these studio lights still matters in a time of social media, because I think some of these processes may be the same or similar.
I totally agree with that analysis, that there is still so much that hasn't been resolved, that is still the same depending on what media we look at. It doesn't really matter here, but it's the human reaction to these moments. That would be definitely one reason why I'd say that it still works so well. I also think it's just a completely engaging film per se. I think no matter the context, even if we took away some of these timely elements from it, it's still so engaging and so well built up and just such a great watch to go into with certain expectations and then have these expectations shattered and thrown to the wall and get something altogether differently. Such a clever build up. That's the second reason I would see for myself, and how in a way, thirdly, then the characters are so central still, that their tragedy and their not being able really to shift the dynamics that evolve is at the center of this film. And I think this Sonny especially, but then also by extension Sal and Leon and everyone involved, how that is kind of a, again, the word network comes to mind, and an intricate network of how much agency you have in such a situation. You bring yourself into a predicament, and then there are certain options, and by choosing one option you'll exclude some others, and not inexplicably but inadvertently you move towards an ending and that's something that turns out a certain way, and it's involved by all the people around it and affected by it. And I think that film also lays out such an intricate network of relationships then and outcomes, and at the end there is, I guess, only one outcome really.
Yeah, and I think what I would add is that without all these things, it would still work as a film of its time. We alluded to the intro early, which sets it in the time that this heist happened and this film was made. So beyond the language and beyond all the themes of this, it still works, I think, as a time bubble where you could look at it almost like a photo album of a certain time in a very specific place, which Lumet loves, New York, with very specific people, which happened in a certain specific way. And I think it would still work even if it had just been a flat-out heist film because of that.
And I think doesn't that say all about it, that we said in a way both things, that it works as a portrait of its time, that it has all these elements of the mid-1970s, but at the same time it also works as a great movie, how it evolves with the main characters at the center that we care for, with the build up, with the clever writing, with the good dialogue, with the humanity. So maybe if we take all these elements together, that's probably what makes it the great movie that we discovered, you much earlier than I did, and I only a few days ago, how great it is. And it's definitely one I want to watch again, including more by Lumet, now that I've discovered how much I haven't seen and how many different styles there are still to discover. So thanks so much for recommending it, for pointing that one out to me. I was totally engaged and totally grateful as well.
And I want to geek out about my, this is totally self-serving, I always love geeking out with you about my favorites.
Let's continue there also in upcoming episodes. So thank you, listeners, for staying with us as we discussed and dive deeply on a winter afternoon into Dog Day afternoon. Thanks so much, Julie, for joining me for this.
Thank you.
And join us for another episode of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. Bye-bye.
Bye.